Chapter 9. We Contain Multitudes. We humans aren't just a genetically diverse species. We are also culturally diverse. It's a big part of what makes our world so interesting and our relationships so rewarding. This diversity of opinion and approach is a great asset for our species, but also sometimes comes at a cost. We approach a range of issues related in one way or another to the future of human genetic engineering, including how we treat the environment, how we grow our food, and how we think about when life begins, very differently. When differences over issues like these become too great, we have argued, we have competed politically to gain an upper hand, and sometimes we have fought to prove our righteousness. Exploring how we handled these past debates on issues adjacent to human genetic engineering gives us both an indication of what we might expect as the genetic revolution plays out, and a warning about just how difficult it will be to chart a common path forward. Genetic engineering involves altering nature in ways our ancestors could hardly have imagined. Our forebears, swimming in the oceans, crawling onto the land, and swinging in the trees, didn't have the capacity to massively disrupt the environment. We were just one among many species struggling to survive in the hostile and dangerous world around us, facing repeated bouts of near starvation and ravaged by diseases, and fighting off predators trying to kill us. But as soon as we could, we humans fought back hard against the vagaries of nature. We developed weapons to kill other animals and occasionally each other, agriculture to secure a stable source of calories, and medicines to fight against the afflictions of nature. Some human communities were more rapacious than others, but all molded the world to our needs. Even hunter-gatherer societies with traditions revering the natural forces around them were likely responsible for mass extinctions of other species. After the ancestors of the Native American Indians crossed the Bering Strait 13,000 years ago, for example, huge numbers of species in the New World, including mammoths, mastodons, dire wolves, giant beavers, and camelops, quickly went extinct. The same destruction of the natural habitat happened after the first humans arrived in Hawaii, New Zealand, Easter Island, and many other places. Early Western theologians referenced the Old Testament to justify human domination of nature. "Let us make man in our image," God says in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, "and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." After using the philosophy of dominion to justify conquering the natural world and destroying their environment at home, European societies used their new scientific and industrial capabilities to brutally colonize and ruthlessly exploit the rest of the world. In the second half of the 20th century, majority European sensibilities shifted, and Europeans became the world's leading environmentalists and champions of global efforts to slow climate change. European settlers in the United States cut down vast forests to build plantations, wiped out large ecosystems when covering the land with farms, and hunted animals like the bison to near extinction for sport. But then preservationists like John Muir inspired Teddy Roosevelt to create America's first national parks, and environmental consciousness grew. In the three remarkable years between 1969 and 1971, Friends of the Earth, the Natural Resources Defense Council, Greenpeace, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, were created, and the first Earth Day was proclaimed. China has similarly undergone a series of about-faces in popular and governmental perceptions of nature. Traditional Chinese culture valued a sense of harmony between humans and nature. The unity of man and nature, Qianren He Yi, is prominent in major Chinese schools of thought like Confucianism and Taoism. If close nets are not allowed to enter the pools and ponds, the great 4th century BC philosopher Mencius wrote, the fishes and turtles will be more than can be consumed. If the axes and bills enter the hills and forests only at the proper time, the wood will be more than can be used. As with other cultures, this harmony was an ideal not always realized. After Mao and the Chinese communists seized power in 1949, this nature-respecting traditional philosophy was turned on its head with a vengeance. In an effort to speed up China's modernization, Mao launched the Great Leap Forward in 1958. To build an agricultural surplus to support industrialization, peasant farmers were forced into communes and told to plant up to 10 times more seeds in their fields than they had previously done. The crops died from overdensity. Because sparrows were eating some of the crops that remained, Mao and party leaders called on children to search out and destroy sparrow nests, and on farmers to bang pots and pans together to drive the sparrows to exhaustion. After millions of sparrows were killed, the insect populations predictably exploded, further devastating agricultural yields. Even in this downward spiral, peasant farmers were ordered to build backyard furnaces to melt metals that could be used to speed up industrialization. Trees around the country were cut down to make wood for these useless furnaces, decimating China's forests. When drought arrived, Mao's China was wholly unprepared. Between 1958 and 1962, an estimated 45 million Chinese people died, the greatest man-made famine in history on the back of Mao's great ecocide. China's destruction of its environment continued after Mao, even as the country implemented smarter industrialization policies. In 1978, newly installed Premier Deng Xiaoping began a process of opening China's economy that paved the way for the country's rapid growth. Led mostly by engineers, the Chinese Communist Party behaved as if all of life could be engineered. It adopted a one-child policy to engineer the population. Massive works projects like the Three Gorges Dam and the South-to-North Water Diversion Project to engineer the environment, and industrial policies to engineer growth, with little regard for pollution, safety, or worker rights. As China became the fastest-growing economy in history over the next 4 decades, the grow-at-all-costs philosophy led to the contamination of the vast majority of its waterways, the poisoning of its air, and the transformation of previously verdant lands into deserts. But facing the threat of revolt from newly empowered middle class choking on China's air and being poisoned by its food, recent Chinese leaders like Xi Jinping have made cleaning up China's environment a priority. All of these twists and turns in national approaches to environmental protection make clear that the national and communal ideologies that will guide our future actions on genetically altering ourselves will not be uniform within or especially between societies. At its core, the coming debate over human genetic engineering will be a debate about how far we as a species, made up of many diverse groups with very different views on whether and how much to alter the biology bequeathed to us by evolution, will go. These types of distinct philosophies about our relation to nature have played out very differently in various societies in our contentious debates over genetically modified crops. Our ancestors were selectively breeding plants long before Gregor Mendel figured out the mechanism governing the transfer of traits across generations. Understanding the rules of genetics made researchers even better able to breed all sorts of organisms with particular genetic traits. By understanding more of what genes are and do, scientists were able to go one step further by transferring genetic material from one organism to another. In 1973, Stanford Medical School graduate student Stanley Cohen and his professor Herbert Boyer transferred a gene that provided antibiotic resistance from one strain of bacteria to another that lacked this resistance. When the second bacteria became antibiotic resistant, the new era of genetically modified organisms, GMOs, was born. GMOs are plants, animals, and other organisms whose genetic material has been changed by humans to a form that does not generally occur on its own in nature, particularly by transferring genes between species. Soon after, a microbiologist working for General Electric filed a patent for a genetically engineered bacteria designed to break down crude oil, potentially very useful in addressing oil spills. GE's patent application was rejected because the U.S. Patent Office rules clearly indicated that living things could not be patented. But after GE appealed, the U.S. Supreme Court shocked the world in its 1980 ruling that a live, human-made microorganism is patentable subject matter. If life could be patented, the race was on to build the portfolio. But as new companies like Genentech and Amgen rapidly built their businesses, others began worrying about the potential dangers of what scientists began calling recombinant DNA, the process of combining genetic materials from multiple organisms to create genetic sequences not otherwise found in nature. A prominent group of scientists called on the director of the U.S. National Institutes of Health to establish a special committee to evaluate the potential biological and ecological hazards of this new technology and ways of preventing the unintended spread of recombinant DNA molecules across the human, animal, and crop populations. In 1975, some of America's leading scientists got together with ethicists, lawyers, and government officials at the Asilomar Conference Grounds in Pacific Grove, California, to hash out proposed standards for how the new tools of recombinant DNA should and should not be used. Setting these types of standards was critical as the applications of GMO technologies increased. In 1982, the FDA approved the sale of insulin made from genetically modified bacteria to diabetic consumers. 2 years later, the U.S. Department of Agriculture approved the sale of Calgene's Flavor Saver tomatoes, genetically modified to ripen more slowly and last longer on the shelves. In the ensuing years, the U.S. market for genetically modified seeds grew exponentially, driven by powerful multinational corporations like Bayer, Dow, DuPont, Monsanto, and Syngenta. By 2000, most of the corn, soybeans, and cotton grown in the United States was genetically modified. Genetically modified crop adoption levels kept growing because farmers believed that planting GM seeds increased yields and profits and reduced the need for pesticides. The U.S. public also largely came along. A series of Pew polls between 1999 and 2003 found that the majority of Americans knew little about the genetic modification of crops, about a third were concerned by it, and about a fifth thought it was safe. By 2016, most Americans remained largely uninformed about GM crops, the same third of Americans polled were concerned about GMOs, and 58% believed that GM crops were either equivalent to or better for people's health than non-GM crops. A 2016 business report found that over two-thirds of all U.S. grocery shoppers were not willing to pay any extra for non-genetically modified foods and projected that, with the continuous increase in the pricing of non-GM food products, consumers will switch to GM food products. China, too, has steadily adopted genetically modified crops. With only 9% of the world's arable land, but 20% of its population, the country has always been food insecure. For the Chinese government, genetic modification has long seemed an appealing way to increase the crop yields of smaller and more marginal farms, grow the cotton needed for the country's massive textile operations, and feed China's people and massive herds of livestock. Today, around 60% of global soybean exports go to China, nearly all of it genetically engineered. Recognizing the critical importance of GMO and other agricultural technologies to their future, the Chinese government classified enhanced agriculture as a strategic emerging industry in the government's most recent 5-year plan. China must boldly research and innovate, dominate the high points of GMO techniques, Chinese President Xi Jinping said in 2013, and cannot let foreign companies dominate the GMO market. This government push was the animating force behind the $43 billion 2017 acquisition of the Swiss multinational corporation Syngenta, one of the world's leading agricultural biotechnology behemoths, by the Chinese state-owned enterprise ChemChina. Even though Chinese public concern about GM has increased in conjunction with the country's repeated food safety scandals, polls show that a significant majority of Chinese consumers, like their American counterparts but unlike the Europeans, generally accept genetically modified foods. The growing GM adoption rate in the United States and China isn't just based on consumer ignorance, it is also based on science. As the prevalence of GM crops has grown, researchers have acquired an ever-expanding data set they have used to evaluate safety risks. Study after study over decades has repeatedly shown that genetically modified crops are as safe as conventional ones. The 2012 statement of the American Association for the Advancement of Science Board of Directors found that crop improvement by the modern molecular techniques of biotechnology is safe. The 2013 literature review in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry found overwhelming evidence that GM crops are less disruptive of crop composition compared with traditional breeding, which itself has a tremendous history of safety. The European Union Europe 2020 report, as well as studies by the World Health Organization, the American Medical Association, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, the British Royal Society, and other of the most respected organizations in the world have all reached the same conclusion. If that's not enough evidence that GM crops are safe, the U.S. National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine in 2016 published their comprehensive review of the science of GMOs. This massive meta-analysis reviewed all credible GMO studies to date from around the world, consulted hundreds of the top experts, and received comments from more than 700 concerned individuals and organizations. Based on all of these inputs from around the world in the most systematic review of GM crops ever, the National Academy's report found no conclusive evidence of cause and effect relationships between GE, aka GM, crops and environmental problems, and no evidence of any increase or decrease in specific health problems after the introduction of GE foods. Although the report did recognize the danger of herbicide-resistant weeds and some other challenges, the overall message was clear. Genetically modified crops are as safe for human consumption as non-GM crops. An Italian study, released in February 2018, went a step further. Reviewing more than 20 years of data from multiple studies around the world, the authors concluded that genetic modification actually increased yields and reduced carcinogenic toxins in corn. Genetically modified corn wasn't just safe for human consumption, it was, according to this study, even healthier for us than non-GMO corn. That GM crops are safe to eat, however, does not mean there are not legitimate issues of concern. If we over-rely on certain crops or allow corporations to gain monopoly powers over our food supply or inadvertently create super-resistant pests, we could have real problems. GM is a tool with a huge upside and a potential downside that requires thoughtful regulation. Despite all of these studies showing GMOs are safe, however, the scientific story of GMOs has been increasingly overcome by overblown fears in many parts of the Western world. In 1990, American environmental activists published a report titled biotechnology's Bitter Harvest, condemning the growing spread of genetically engineered plants and calling on the U.S. government to cut off its support for this technology. Since then, anti-GMO activists, many inspired by some combination of a distrust of new technologies, U.S. global corporations, and market capitalism more generally, as well as by the romanticizing of small farmers and fears their food supplies will be contaminated, have increasingly raised the alarm over what they started calling Frankenfoods. Anti-GMO organizations have launched massive disinformation campaigns designed to counter and muffle the voices of the scientific community. Many people are susceptible to this type of disinformation because most of us instinctively resort to a naturalistic fallacy that nature is natural, even though our ancestors have been massively modifying much of it for thousands of years. That large and vilified multinational corporations like Monsanto stand to make significant profits from this burgeoning industry also didn't help. This activism struck a particular chord in Europe. By 2016, 84% of Europeans polled had heard of genetically modified foods, and a full 70% concluded that GM foods were fundamentally unnatural. 61% believed that the development of GM crops should be discouraged, and 59% that GM foods were unsafe. As these voices of public dissent became louder, European regulators listened. Even though Belgian scientists were pioneers of modern plant genetic engineering in the 1980s, a decade later, European regulators became the first to require that GM foods be labeled. Labeling may superficially seem a good idea, but is inherently dishonest because so many of the enzymes in foods we eat and the crops that feed our livestock are genetically modified. Accepting full labeling of GMOs would require labeling much of what we eat. In spite of the many potential benefits of GM crops, anti-GMO organizations like Greenpeace, Earth Liberation Front, and others have repeatedly and forcibly disrupted GMO research and destroyed GM crop trials in research institutes around the world. In 2011, Greenpeace admitted its members had broken into an Australian research facility to destroy experimental genetically modified wheat crops. In 2013, activists partnering with Greenpeace uprooted research paddies of the vitamin-enhanced golden rice at the renowned International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines. As pressure on the European Union grew, European leaders recognized that the clash of public opinion on the one hand and science and economic competitiveness on the other was creating an untenable situation. In an effort to escape the public opinion straitjacket, EU environment ministers in 2013 agreed that individual EU countries could each decide for themselves whether to restrict GM crops for any reason. Responding more to public opinion than science, 17 European countries banned the cultivation of GM crops by 2015. As former anti-GMO campaigner turned GMO advocate Mark Linus wrote at the time, "In effect, the continent is shutting up shop for an entire field of human scientific and technological endeavor. This is analogous to America's declaring an automobile boycott in 1910, or Europe's prohibiting the printing press in the 15th century." A European Academy's Science Advisory Council declared that the EU was falling behind international competitors in agricultural innovation, which had implications for EU goals for science and innovation, and for the environment as well as for agriculture. By then, it was too late. The European anti-GM train had already left the station. In Berlin in 2015, I met with a number of the German regulators involved with enforcing the country's restrictions on GM crops. Every one of them told me they thought the restrictions were unscientific, counterproductive, and asinine. All of them said they were required to restrict GMOs against their better judgment because public opinion had forced the hand of Germany and Europe's political leaders. A few described how Greenpeace, the leading anti-GMO campaigner, had allegedly lobbied against the labeling of genetically modified enzymes used in most cheeses, breads, wines, and beers as GMOs out of an apparent fear that if people understood how reliant we are on GMOs, the anti-GMO campaign would collapse. And even though new gene editing techniques like CRISPR are making it possible to turn on or off already existing genes within crops to alter traits, and are therefore not technically GMOs, Greenpeace and the anti-GMO forces are beginning to rally in opposition. In 2016, 109 Nobel laureates issued an open letter calling on Greenpeace to end its anti-GMO campaign. "We urge Greenpeace and its supporters," the letter said, "to re-examine the experience of farmers and consumers worldwide with crops and foods improved through biotechnology, recognize the findings of authoritative scientific bodies and regulatory agencies, and abandon their campaign against GMOs in general and golden rice in particular. The scientific and regulatory agencies around the world have repeatedly and consistently found crops and foods improved through biotechnology to be as safe as, if not safer than, those derived from any other method of production. There has never been a single confirmed case of a negative health outcome for humans or animals from their consumption. Their environmental impacts have been shown repeatedly to be less damaging to the environment and a boon to global biodiversity." Despite the impassioned pleas of the expert community, the impact of the anti-GMO campaign remains high, particularly in Europe. These efforts scored a major victory in July 2018, when Europe's highest court, the Court of Justice of the European Union, ruled that gene-edited crops altered with new gene-editing techniques like CRISPR would be subject to the same strict regulation as GM crops, even though no outside genetic material was being introduced. "This will have a chilling effect on research, in the same way that GMO legislation has had a chilling effect for 15 years now," Umeå University plant physiologist Stefan Janssen told Nature. Europe's GMO bans hurt the continent's economic competitiveness, but don't risk the lives of any European citizens. The same could not be said for the impact of these policies on the developing world. European restrictions on certain agricultural imports from countries with GM crops forced many African and Asian governments, depending on those export markets for their economic well-being, to themselves restrict planting genetically modified crops. This denied poor countries the opportunity to use biotechnology to generate bigger yields of virus-resistant crops, reduce use of fertilizer and dangerous pesticides, add life-saving nutrients to their diets, and help minimize the impact of droughts that can cause thousands of deaths, hardly a benign outcome. The Nobel laureates reserved their harshest criticism of Greenpeace for its opposition to golden rice. "Greenpeace has spearheaded opposition to golden rice," they wrote, "which has the potential to reduce or eliminate much of the death and disease caused by a vitamin A deficiency, VAD, which has the greatest impact on the poorest people in Africa and Southeast Asia." The World Health Organization estimates that 250 million people suffer from VAD, including 40% of the children under 5 in the developing world. Based on UNICEF statistics, a total of 1 to 2 million preventable deaths occur annually as a result of VAD because it compromises the immune system, putting babies and children at great risk. VAD itself is the leading cause of childhood blindness, globally affecting 250,000 to 500,000 children each year. Half die within 12 months of losing their eyesight. We call upon Greenpeace to cease and desist in its campaign against golden rice specifically, and crops and foods improved through biotechnology in general. How many poor people in the world must die before we consider this a crime against humanity? Although Africa's restrictions on GM crops have recently begun to loosen, there is little doubt that European and activist NGO scaremongering has delayed the adoption of GM crops in Africa and elsewhere. The application of genetic modification and gene editing to crops has the potential to significantly improve the resilience and sustainability of our food supply and make living on our warming planet with its growing human population more feasible and survivable. While the arguments of the anti-GMO campaigners are not entirely without merit and should be considered, there is little doubt that the scaremongering anti-GMO campaign is doing far more harm than good. The GM crops experience shows how heated the debates over altering what different people perceive differently as nature can become. The GMO debate also gives us a good indication of what might be heading our way when the organisms being genetically modified are not soybeans and corn, but us. And we've already heard how sensitive and volatile ideological divisions can become when human reproduction is at stake. Humans have been performing abortions for most of our recorded history. Early records of abortions go back to 1550 BC in Egypt. Abortion was commonplace and widely accepted in ancient Greece and Rome. Plato and Aristotle both explicitly endorse in their writings the right of women to receive abortions. Chinese archives from as early as 500 BC describe mercury being used to end pregnancies. In 1803, the British Parliament made abortion after 5 months of pregnancy, when it was then believed the soul entered the fetus, punishable by execution. The penalty was later reduced to life imprisonment for whoever performed the abortion. Although abortion was common in colonial America, restrictions in the United States started in the 1850s, forcing American women who sought to terminate their pregnancies to have even less sanitary and more dangerous abortions than the already low medical standards of the day, and leading to thousands of unnecessary deaths. Although the UK Abortion Act of 1967 and the landmark 1973 U.S. Supreme Court decision in the case of Roe v. Wade established a woman's right to an abortion in both countries, the abortion issue was far from settled. In the years following Roe v. Wade, the Catholic Church and evangelical Christians rallied against abortion with increasing intensity, eventually gaining the political support of America's Republican Party. Although the Roe decision held and abortion rights remained protected in more liberal states like California and New York, pressures to restrict abortion intensified in more conservative U.S. states. In the 40 years after Roe, nearly 300 violent attacks, including arson and bombings, were carried out against abortion clinics, and abortion providers were even murdered across the United States. The National Abortion Federation additionally reported over 176,000 incidents of abortion clinics being picketed over the past four decades, 1,500 acts of vandalism, and 400 death threats. As a result of these types of pressures and the 1977 Hyde Amendment that significantly restricted the use of federal funds for abortion, today, 84% of U.S. counties provide no abortion services, and only 17 U.S. states fund abortions on terms similar to other health services. In China, the Communist Party quickly banned most abortions after coming to power in 1949 to spur population growth. But after taking over in 1978, following Mao's death and a power struggle, Deng Xiaoping believed his economic reform plans could only work if China's population growth could be slowed. His government launched the one-child policy in 1979, limiting most Han Chinese families, particularly those in urban areas, to a single child. In support of this policy, China legalized abortion in 1988. Over the following nearly four decades, the one-child policy was in force. Most families that had more than one child were heavily fined, and a large number of women were forced to have abortions and/or be sterilized without their consent. The one-child policy eased any stigma surrounding abortion and encouraged many parents, sometimes inadvertently and sometimes directly, to abort female embryos, place female babies for adoption, and abandon children born with disabilities. Although the one-child policy was finally eased in 2015, the policy subtracted around 400 million people from China's otherwise predicted population growth. But even with government pressure relaxed, the Chinese public remained, on average, considerably more comfortable with abortion than their American counterparts. Unlike Western religions that traditionally ascribe humanity as a divine creation, the Chinese tend to see themselves as descendants of their own parents, a foundation of the ancient rite of ancestor worship. These ideas also underpin the Confucian concept of filial piety, a major foundation of Chinese culture, which highly values producing healthy and capable offspring to carry on the family legacy. Today, abortion remains widely accepted in China. Around the world, these types of different cultural traditions and legal norms have inspired different levels of acceptance and comfort with abortion. These types of different communal views on abortion show up in public opinion polling from around the world. In 2017, for example, 58% of Americans polled believed abortion should be legal or mostly legal, while 40% believed it should be illegal or mostly illegal. Not surprisingly, Jewish, Buddhist, and unaffiliated Americans supported abortion rights the most, while Catholics, Evangelicals, Mormons, and Jehovah's Witnesses opposed most strongly. A 2015 BuzzFeed poll of 23 countries found, not surprisingly, that liberal European countries were most permissive of abortions, while more Christian and traditional Latin American, Asian, and African countries less so. These differences in belief show up in the wide range of laws regulating abortion in different jurisdictions around the world. According to Pew's 2015 analysis of global abortion laws, 26% of the 196 countries surveyed allow abortions only to save the life of the mother, and an additional 42% place significant restrictions on abortion. Most of these restricting countries are ones where religious institutions play a leading role in society. All of the six countries banning abortion under any circumstances are countries where the church dominates. These different legal structures explain why women living in Louisiana, one of the U.S. states with the toughest restrictions on abortion, travel out of state when they need abortions, or why women from Andorra, where abortions are banned, cross the border to France when seeking theirs. The disparities between how different communities approach and regulate abortion is not just a precursor to the genetically modified humans debate, but a central component of it. Because IVF and embryo selection, the gateway procedures for heritable human genetic engineering, nearly always entail the destruction or at least permanent freezing of unimplanted embryos, the politics of abortion is already morphing into the politics of assisted reproduction, embryo screening, and human gene editing. America's Hyde Amendment is a perfect example of this. Inspired by the abortion debate, the amendment also created significant restrictions on human genetics research in the United States. If people have gone ballistic over the environmental, GMO, and abortion debates, if they have manned the barricades and destroyed research centers over genetically modified crops, or attacked abortion clinics and murdered doctors, Imagine what they might do when the same diversity of individual, cultural, societal, and governmental views inspires different national approaches to the emerging science of genetically modified people. In 2016, a French activist group called Alliance Vita launched a campaign to stop GM babies with a petition. Petition: CRISPR-Cas9, yes to therapeutic progress, no to transgenic embryos. Men deserve to be cared and not genetically programmed. For the past few months, the use of the CRISPR-Cas9 technology has been sharply increased. This technique allows to modify directly the DNA, genome, of any vegetable, animal, or human cell. This technology is promising to treating various genetic diseases in children and adults. But when applied to human embryos, it can produce from scratch genetically modified humans, GM babies. A worldwide ethical regulatory framework must be implemented. GM babies? No. By signing this petition, I ask my country to urgently undertake and secure an international moratorium, meaning an immediate halt, on genetic modification of human embryos, in particular using the CRISPR-Cas9 technology. Signed by more than 10,000 people, this petition was not a wild success, but was a harbinger of things to come. The future debate over genetically modified humans could be, at least in some ways, less contentious than the abortion struggle if the benefits of human genetic engineering can be widely experienced by the public more quickly than the fear-mongering can take hold. IVF is a good example of this. In 1978, just after the birth of Louise Brown, 28% of Americans polled said IVF was morally wrong. Relatively quickly, however, people started to witness the benefits of IVF for helping women have babies. This evident success is why we are more likely to see pro-life campaigners picketing abortion clinics than fertility clinics, even if far more early-stage embryos are terminated in the latter. When asked in 2013, only 12% of Americans said IVF was morally wrong, far less than the 40% opposing abortion. On the other hand, public attitudes toward pre-implantation genetic testing and genetically altering embryos have not yet normalized like they have for IVF. 74% of Americans surveyed in a 2002 Johns Hopkins University poll expressed support for using pre-implantation embryo screening to avoid serious disease, but only 28% were comfortable using it to select the gender of a child, and 20% approved of using it to select for desirable, non-disease-related traits like intelligence. Gene editing pre-implanted embryos is, of course, a more significant intervention than selecting which embryo to implant in the mother. When asked by Stat and Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health in 2016 whether they thought gene editing should be used to improve the intelligence or physical characteristics on an unborn child, only 17% of Americans agreed. A Pew poll 2 years later similarly found that only 19% of Americans would be willing to change their baby's genes to make the baby more intelligent. But when asked if they would be willing to gene edit their own future children to significantly reduce their baby's risk of serious disease, nearly half of the Americans polled said yes in 2016, and that number increased to 72% in the 2018 poll. These polls not only show that Americans are more comfortable with interventions having a clear medical purpose than with everything else, but also that parents will, conceptually at least, aggressively protect their future children from risk, including by altering their children's genetics. The polls also indicate that popular American comfort levels with these types of interventions are growing. Like with the abortion polling, religious Americans are far more restrictive in their attitudes toward gene-editing embryos than are the non-religious. The United Kingdom has seen perhaps the greatest shift toward increased acceptance of more aggressive genetic interventions. A third of Britons polled in 2001 felt that genetics research writ large was unethical and tampering with nature. By 2017, however, 83% of UK residents surveyed by the Royal Society supported gene editing to cure serious disease when the genetic changes would not be passed to future generations. 76% supported editing human genes to correct genetic disorders even when the genetic changes would be passed to future generations. An astounding 40% supported using genetic engineering to enhance human abilities like intelligence. The British population has experienced the highest level of public education on genetic technologies in the world, particularly in the context of the national conversation on mitochondrial transfer. This, plus the United Kingdom's pro-science and open-minded national orientation, have translated into over three-quarters of the population supporting the genetic alteration of embryos in ways that would be passed to future generations forever, and nearly half the population expressing a willingness to genetically enhance their own future children. Although China was far behind the West in assisted reproduction technologies only a decade ago, the country is showing the biggest global swing toward widespread acceptance of assisted reproduction. Living in a society where religious faith has been suppressed for decades, screening and aborting embryos is seen as less of a religious issue in China than in most other countries. The ancient Chinese concepts of taijiao, or fetal education, and yosheng, healthy birth, emphasize the importance of birthing optimally healthy babies. Along with the significant Chinese cultural stigma surrounding and lack of institutional support for people with disabilities, these concepts have paved the way for a greater societal acceptance of embryo screening in China than in most other countries. By 2004, only 4 clinics in China had a license to perform PGT. By 2016, the number had risen to 40. 40 may not seem like a big number for a country as vast as China, but many of these clinics are now operating on a colossal scale far beyond clinics anywhere else. One single clinic in Changsha, a city near Beijing, reported 41,000 IVF procedures in 2016, a quarter of the total number carried out in the entire United States and more than in the entire United Kingdom that same year. Across China, PGT is growing by an average of 60-70% annually. Costing a third of the U.S. price, the total number of these procedures in China is already greater than that in the United States and climbing. Chinese clinics are advertising their ability to use PGT to eliminate the risk of a growing number of genetic diseases. When asked in a 2017 online survey, the Chinese people surveyed on average mildly agreed they would be comfortable genetically altering their future children. These societal differences between the United States, the United Kingdom, and China may ultimately end up being less significant than the generational differences, where younger people appear more comfortable with genetic engineering than their elders. As in the abortion context, religious differences are also already pushing communities in different directions on these issues. Most, but not all, religions accept that gene therapies can and even should be used to treat and cure diseases when genetic changes are not passed to future generations. But the holy water gets murkier from there. The Catholic Church strongly opposes the use of PGT in conjunction with any type of embryo selection. In his 1995 Evangelium Vitae, Pope John Paul II wrote that prenatal diagnostic techniques incorporate a eugenic intention that accepts selective abortion in order to prevent the birth of children affected by various types of anomalies. This, he wrote, is shameful and utterly reprehensible, since it presumes to measure the value of a human life only within the parameters of normality and physical well-being, thus opening the way to legitimizing infanticide and euthanasia. In 2013, the Catholic Church opposed the draft British law authorizing clinical trials of mitochondrial transfer, citing a 1987 Vatican instruction that medical research must refrain from operations on live embryos unless there is a moral certainty of not causing harm to the life or integrity of the unborn child. The National Council of Churches of Christ, a more progressive Protestant group, expressed in its 2016 report a greater appreciation for the role heritable genetic manipulation might play. Effective germline therapy could, the report said, offer tremendous potential for eliminating genetic disease, but it would raise difficult distinctions about normal human conditions that could support discrimination against people with disabilities. But that's not as far as Christian liberalism extends. At a 2017 conference on the future of AI I attended at Ditchley Manor in Oxfordshire, England, I met a fascinating Presbyterian minister, Christopher Bennick, who describes himself as a techno-theologian and Christian transhumanist. Humans are co-creators with Christ, he argued, and stewards of technologies like AI and gene editing that can be used to improve upon humanity. In his writing, he calls for an ethical and helpful use of emerging technologies to enhance humans. Chris's views are certainly at the fringes of Christian theology, but they are probably a little closer to the center of gravity of Jewish thought. The traditional Jewish concept of tikkun olam, or repair the world, suggests that the world is broken, and it is the responsibility of each Jew, as God's agent, to help fix it. All that was created during the 6 days of creation, the Torah says in Genesis chapter 11, verse 6, requires improvement. The wheat needs to be ground, and even a person needs improvement. Completing God's creation in this sense is seen not as a critique of the divine, but as embracing man's divine purpose. Judaism doesn't have the type of hierarchical command structure as Christianity, but even the more conservative Orthodox Jewish communities were, as the Tay Sachs example shows, the earliest adopters of advanced genetic technologies. In a 2015 article in a Jewish medical journal, Rabbi Moshe Tendler of Yeshiva University and bioethicist John Loick make the case for why Jewish law supports Jewish women participating in clinical trials of mitochondrial replacement therapy, MRT, even though this treatment could ultimately result in the birth of genetically altered babies. Jewish law, they wrote, permits women to engage in new biotechnologies such as MRT to have healthy offspring, and volunteering for such trials is not only a chesed, an act of loving kindness, but engenders social responsibility so that Jews are contributing to the overall health of our society. Being open to some genetic alterations does not mean, of course, that transhumanist Christianity, mainstream Judaism, progressive Buddhism, and other communities of faith are signing up for the slippery slope to unlimited transhumanism. But the diversity of beliefs on human genetic enhancement is already significant within and between religious and intellectual traditions, and is more likely than not to grow as genetic technologies come of age. As this happens, science in general and transhumanist aspirations in particular will increasingly take on some of the trappings of a religion. Even in this human genetic revolution, these types of significant differences within and between individuals, communities, and governments about heritable genetic engineering are beginning to play out in a great diversity of national laws. There is no U.S. federal legislation covering IVF in the United States, and America also has among the most accommodating regulatory structures for PGT. U.S. federal law bans funding for research in which embryos are destroyed, but the ways in which genetic screens are used during PGT is almost entirely left to the discretion of doctors themselves, guided by their medical professional organizations. As a result, an estimated 9% of all PGT carried out in the United States is for gender selection, which is illegal in countries like China, India, Canada, and the United Kingdom. A small number of U.S. clinics even allow prospective parents to affirmatively select embryos to ensure children will have genetic disorders like dwarfism or deafness, unthinkable in other parts of the world. No common legislation governs assisted reproduction in Europe, resulting in a patchwork of different laws and regulations. Most European states stipulate that PGT can only be used to select against serious and incurable diseases. Some countries, like Italy and Germany, are more restrictive, while others, like France and the United Kingdom, have established broader regulatory bodies, the Agence de la Biomédecine in France and the United Kingdom's Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, that tend to be more permissive when reviewing PGT applications. Because a 2008 European Commission directive makes all Europeans free to travel without penalty to other EU countries for treatments, including PGT, that may be restricted at home, the impact of various national restrictions is muted. In countries with strong religious leanings, including Chile, the Ivory Coast, the Philippines, Algeria, Ireland, and Austria, PGT is banned. If someone wants to get PGT in Chile or select a boy in China, they can find an underground clinic, travel to another country, or simply not have it done. A recent survey showed that 5% of those receiving assisted reproduction care in European clinics and 4% in the United States were people traveling from abroad to circumvent restrictions and other barriers in their home countries. Among the more advanced countries, Australia, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, and the Netherlands prohibit gene-editing embryos in ways that would be passed to future generations, most imposing criminal penalties against violators. Rather than banning germline manipulations up front, a second set of countries, including France, Israel, Japan, and the Netherlands, make it illegal to initiate a human pregnancy with a genetically modified embryo. A third set of countries, including the United Kingdom, carves out very specific exceptions to a ban and establishes regulatory structures for making case-by-case decisions about what types of heritable changes can be allowed. The United States doesn't have a ban on heritable genetic alteration of embryos per se, but has other regulatory structures that make this type of activity all but impossible. China, on the other hand, has decent laws restricting heritable human genetic manipulation, but a weak and often inconsistent oversight culture, a Wild West mentality among some researchers, and a very large, unlicensed gray market of assisted reproduction clinics. That's why it was no surprise the highly controversial alleged first gene editing of the human embryos apparently taken to term in November 2018 happened in a Chinese laboratory with no oversight from the university or government. Other countries have no significant laws on human genetic alteration. Some among these are positioning themselves as future destinations for unrestricted human reproductive tourism. Because genetic data will be so critical to both the personalized healthcare of individuals and the deciphering of human genetics more generally, and also so susceptible to misuse by others, societies will have good reason to safeguard the genetic information of its citizens. Here again, national variation is big and growing. Different countries regulate and protect the privacy of genetic and other data very differently. America's 2008 Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA, Canada's Genetic Non-Discrimination Act, the United Kingdom's 2010 Equalities Act, and Australia's Genetic Privacy and Non-Discrimination Bill prohibit discrimination based on genetic information in health insurance and employment, but provide far less sweeping consumer genetic data protections than in the European Union. The EU has gone the farthest in protecting individual privacy rights. In May 2018, the EU's Revolutionary General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, came into effect. By far the most aggressive data protection law in the world, the GDPR enshrined the privacy rights of EU citizens to control access to data collected on them anywhere in the world, and placed strong new obligations on companies to safeguard that data. Although the international debate over GDPR has largely centered on the pressure it places on U.S. tech giants like Google and Facebook, the implications for genetic privacy are equally significant. Under the GDPR, each subject must give explicit consent for his or her genetic data to be included in a specific data pool or study. China, too, recently passed a comprehensive national data protection law with big implications for genetic information. The 2017 Network Security Law of the People's Republic of China imposed privacy protection mandates on companies and required an individual's consent for any data transferred outside of China. The law also bans the transfer of personal information outside of China if the transfer is deemed to damage Chinese vaguely defined national security, public, and national interests. This requirement applies to what the law calls sensitive personal information, a category including genetic data. Although Europe and China's privacy laws may at first seem similar, they are anything but. In Europe, the GDPR is being deployed to protect individual citizens from their data being used without their consent by anyone, including the government. In China, the new privacy law is ensuring a government monopoly over genetic and other data collected from and about people inside China. While the EU is working to prevent genetic data from being used to create a police state, China's Ministry of Public Security is amassing the world's largest DNA database as, among other things, an investment in social control. Chinese citizens in the country's predominantly Muslim Xinjiang region and other ethnic minorities, migrant workers, potential dissidents, college students, and activists are being required to provide samples to be entered into the national database. Privacy protection may seem like a justifiable human rights issue in the EU and an Orwellian control issue in China, but the reality, as always, is more complex. For most people, the idea of a government or company tracking every aspect of our lives is frightening. From an individual rights perspective, privacy is essential. From a big data analytics perspective, however, it has the potential to be a barrier to pulling together the vast data sets from which actionable insights can be drawn. Because understanding what individual and groups of genes do is the ultimate big data problem, the larger and higher quality the data sets, the more possible it will become to uncover genetic patterns underpinning more complex diseases and traits. Whoever gets the biggest and best data sets will be best poised to lead the genetic revolution with all of the wealth, prestige, power, and influence it will bring. It may end up being the case that China's massive investment in AI, efforts to promote national leadership in life sciences and biotechnology, and ability to bring together massive data sets of sequenced people paired with full access to their electronic medical records will put China in the pole position in global efforts to decode the human genome, transform healthcare, and lead the global genetics revolution. It could alternately be the case that greater privacy protection in the United States and Europe will lead to stronger and more coherent societies, higher standards of genetic and other data collection, and more quality discoveries. Whichever society makes the right bet will be poised to lead the future of innovation. But we should not delude ourselves about what's at stake and the societal costs of making the wrong bet. The environmental, GM crops, abortion, and genetically engineered humans debates show how our different communities, with their diverse histories, cultures, economic pressures, and political structures, respond very differently to new technologies. These dissimilarities then lead to a wide variety of legal and regulatory environments around the world. The good news is that the wide disparity of different approaches is creating a laboratory of nations, each finding its own path as it interacts and competes with other states. In this context, the most promising, and sometimes even the most aggressive, research on and applications of any new technologies will find a home, driving innovation forward. The potentially bad news is that the diversity of communal beliefs and national models could also move humanity toward the lowest common denominator approach to human genetic engineering. If this should happen, the most aggressive countries will set the bar for everyone else, who must keep up if they believe their future well-being, competitive advantage, and prosperity are at stake. Our diversity of approaches, like all forms of diversity, increases the odds of both positive and negative outcomes. Diversity, however, is a biological precondition, but does not alone drive evolution. Evolution also needs that other essential ingredient, competition. If our different orientations about human genetic engineering establish a wide range of options, competition between us will propel our species into the genetic age.